And we're back on Philly Sports Deep Dive. I've not uploaded in a while. I apologize. The schedule for me is getting a little bit jammed. Sports are getting back into season, and I've got a lot of schoolwork to keep up with. But we're going to have a great episode today. Because I haven't uploaded in a while, there's a lot of things to talk about. We're going to start off by talking about the Eagles' biggest free agency moves. We're going to talk about March Madness, the Phillies, and the Sixers. And a little bit of the Flyers. This episode might be a little longer than some of my other ones, so let's get into it. Starting off, we're going to talk about the Eagles and Howie Roseman doing his magic in free agency. But instead of just talking about the moves, I'm actually going to give my grades of every single major free agency move that the Eagles have made. So, let's start off with the obvious one, Saquon Barkley signing to the Eagles. So the Eagles signed former New York Giants running back Saquon Barkley on a 3-year, $37.75 million contract that could be worth up to $46.75 million and includes $26 million fully guaranteed per Adam Schefter. And I'm going to give this move an A. Maybe I'm a little bit biased, because those who know me know I'm a huge Penn State fan, and Saquon Barkley was there when I first started watching college football. But I really do think this is a great move. I think that Kellen Moore, if he utilizes Saquon Barkley right, can really turn this offense around from a down year last year, because Saquon Barkley is dynamic and talented enough that he can single-handedly change an offense. I think he fits the need at running back very well, too, because he can also catch passes out of the backfield, which is something that running backs just haven't been able to do in recent years for the Eagles. Saquon Barkley is just a great signing, in my opinion. Some people think they overpaid for him. They're paying him to be one of the top running backs in the league, and I think he is that. I think playing behind a competent offensive line with a competent quarterback and competent offensive play calling will do wonders for him. He's been stuck with the Giants ever since they drafted him second overall in 2018, and it's shown. The offensive line there is in shambles. The quarterbacks that he's played with have been Daniel Jones, Eli Manning, and Tommy DeVito, none of which were any good when they were playing with Saquon. And we saw it last year with the Giants, the one season with him where they were actually good, and he had a great year that year. So I think maybe a bit overpaid, but not that much, and I think 100% worth it to sign a player of that caliber. I love the Saquon Barkley signing. Next, we got probably the second biggest Eagles free agency signing, them signing Bryce Huff to a 3-year, $51.1 million contract. I'm giving this one a C-. I mean, I just did not like this move from the moment they signed him, because I think he's overpaid. The reason they signed him to a deal this large is because there's a lot of advanced stats and next-gen stats that really do love Bryce Huff. He had a league-leading pressure percentage, but he had only 10 sacks, which isn't bad, don't get me wrong. But in his first three seasons, he only had 7.5 sacks combined. I mean, paying $51.1 million for a guy that really hasn't even proved himself over multiple years yet, it's just insane. They're paying Bryce Huff more than Saquon Barkley, and it's not even close. I mean, I know edge rushers are really valued in today's NFL market, but I mean, this is just ridiculous. And this move is basically also the leeway into them trading Haason Reddick, which I'm going to get into it in a second. But, I mean, this move just doesn't make any sense. Why are you spending all this money on Bryce Huff when you could either spend it on extending Haason Reddick or in other areas that are of a much greater need on this defense? Why are you giving all this money to a guy who was an undrafted free agent and only has 17.5 sacks in his career, which is only a sack and a half more than Haason Reddick had in the entire 2022 season? I can't even believe that they paid him this much. And if they hadn't traded Hassan Reddick, I wouldn't be as harsh about this move, but I just don't think it's good either way. So that's what I'm going to get into now, the Hassan Reddick trade. They traded Hassan Reddick to the New York Jets for a conditional third-round pick that could become a second-round pick if he meets certain playing time requirements. I mean, this is a D-. You're trading a guy who's had five straight 10-plus sack seasons for pennies on the dollar? What's a third-round pick going to turn into? Even if it becomes a second, what's a second-round pick going to turn into? Hassan Reddick, yeah, maybe he had a down year, but he was also very misused by Sean Desai and Matt Patricia. And you're just going to trade him like that? All you had to do was extend him. And instead you chose to sign an unproven guy in Bryce Huff and trade Hassan Reddick for pennies on the dollar. It's ridiculous. This is easily the worst move of the Phillies, the Eagles free agency. You're trading him for hardly anything when he's a very, very talented player and has had very, very good production over the past couple of years. I mean, all you had to do was extend it. This is just the part that doesn't make sense. You paid Bryce Huff $51 million, but you're not going to extend Hassan Reddick when Hassan Reddick is clearly better than Bryce Huff in basically every single way? I mean, Bryce Huff is like strictly a pass rusher who pressures the quarterback and doesn't even get that many sacks. Hassan Reddick gets more sacks, and he's probably a bit better against the run too, even though neither of these guys are really that great against the run. I absolutely despise this move, and this is a very common opinion among Eagles fans because everyone knows this is the wrong move, and I don't see any way that this trade could possibly turn out in the Eagles' favor. It just does not add up to me. I really, really hate this move for the Eagles. Again, it just isn't worth it to trade him for so little and then sign an unproven guy for so much. I don't get it. So, the next move I want to talk about, the Eagles bringing back CJ Gardner-Johnson, to a 3-year deal worth up to $33 million in maximum value. And I'm going to give this one an A-. I like this move. Although CJ Gardner-Johnson said some pretty nasty things about Eagles fans when he left for the Detroit Lions last year, I think he actually did a fairly good job explaining himself and apologizing and rebuilding these bridges that he burned when he left the Eagles. And clearly his absence made a huge difference because the Eagles secondary was just in shambles last year. And this is a good move. I like this move. I don't think he's going to quite replicate the season that he had in 2022, where he had tied for the league lead in interceptions despite missing a couple games with a lacerated kidney. I mean, it's a good move. It's a solid signing. I think CJGJ can be a difference maker, and you've got him locked up for 3 years on a deal that I don't think's too pricey. So I like this deal a lot for the Eagles. So CJ Gardner-Johnson gets an A-. Now the next big signing that the Eagles have made, signing Devin White from the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and I'm going to give this one a B+. Devin White he was a former first-round pick by the Buccaneers, and he was very good in their Super Bowl run. Last year, he ended up splitting snaps with another linebacker on Tampa Bay's roster. He underperformed, but I think this is a low-risk, pretty decent reward move for the Eagles if he works out. They signed him to a 1-year deal worth up to $7.5 million, so little to no risk. This is a guy, again, he was a first-round pick out of LSU. He's had productive years. There are concerns. Isn't good about positioning and being in the right place at the right time, but he also has shown that he has some promise, and I don't think that this move is bad at all, because like, if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. Like, I think he's going to improve the linebacker core nonetheless. I think he's going to be better than the guys we had playing there last year, like Nicholas Morrow. I just think this move does not have much risk, but can have pretty substantial reward if he is able to finally unlock his true potential and have a really good season for the Eagles. So I do really like this move. The next move I want to talk about is the Eagles trading for former Steelers first-round quarterback pick Kenny Pickett. Kenny Pickett, out of Pittsburgh University, selected 20th overall as the only first-round quarterback that 2022 draft class. And I'm going to give this move a B because I think this is good insurance behind Jalen Hurts. It's Kenny Pickett. You got him for relatively cheap, and he's a guy who can hold on to the ball and be smart with the ball, I feel. And I think that it's not bad just to have this kind of insurance on your roster, because I think he can be a quality backup quarterback. Obviously, I don't think he's ever going to pan out as a starting quarterback, because he's just been very lackluster his two seasons with Pittsburgh. But what you got him for is not that much. They traded a third rounder and 2 7ths for Pickett and a fourth rounder. I mean, it's a fair deal, and Pickett will provide good insurance behind Jalen Hurts if anything happens to him. I think if Jalen Hurts is in a situation like he was in 2022, has to miss a couple of games, I think Kenny Pickett could go 2-1, go 3-2 in a couple games. That's Gardner Minshew was kind of similar to Kenny Pickett in that sense. Like, you felt confident in Gardner Minshew that with this Eagles roster, he could win a couple games if you needed him to. And I think Kenny Pickett is the same. So I like the move. Kenny Pickett also more mobile than Minshew was. So he can fit into what the Eagles system is likely going to be pretty well. I think he's a good fit, and this is a very nice deal. The last new addition that I want to briefly talk about with the Eagles is signing Devontae Parker to a one-year deal. I'm going to give this one a C+. Devontae Parker, he's whatever. The Eagles need a third receiver. I think they're probably going to go out and get one in the second or third round of the draft, because Quez Watkins was not able to fill that role, and neither was Olamide Zaccheaus. But I just don't think Devontae Parker really fits that third receiver role, which is why I'm giving him a somewhat low grade. I don't hate the signing. It's never bad to have experienced veteran depth on your roster, and that's basically what Parker provides. And I don't think they're signing him to be their number three guy, because if they are, then this might be lower, because Devontae Parker just does not fit what they want in a third receiver anyway. Because Quez Watkins, he's not good, but he fits the bill. You want someone who can attack the secondary and really just take the top off the defense. And Devontae Parker is the exact opposite. The past couple of years, he's been last in receiver separation. And he's also 31 years old, so really he's lost a bit of his step over the past few years. But I don't hate it, because, again, I just don't think that they are going to... really going to need him to do that much for the Eagles. So that's why I do like this signing for the Eagles a little bit. Again, C+, so it's pretty average. I don't think he'll make that much of a difference, but again, it's never wrong or bad to have some veteran depth on your team. And the last thing I want to talk about with the Eagles is three key extensions that they signed with guys who were already on the team. They signed Brandon Graham back for a year. They extended Jake Elliott, and they also extended Landon Dickerson. And all three of these moves get grouped together for an A. We'll start with Brandon Graham. He's back for a year. This is probably his last year. Famous for strip-sacking Tom Brady in the Super Bowl, but he's still got a productive year left in him. He actually had, when you look at the stats, 2022 is actually a career year coming off that ACL tear. Set a career high in sacks. Obviously, he dipped a little bit last year, but so did everybody else. I think it's important to retain that because you're losing two key leaders in Fletcher Cox and Jason Kelce to retirement. So to keep that veteran leadership that's been there since that Super Bowl run, guys like Brandon Graham, like Lane Johnson, that's important and that's a little bit undervalued in a lot of sports today, but it's important and it definitely affects the team. Jake Elliott gets extended, and I mean, I'm just a huge Jake Elliott fan. When he hit that 59-yarder against the Buffalo Bills this year, I mean, that's when I was just thinking, wow, boy, do we have a good kicker. Jake Elliott is a very, very good kicker. He's just a model of consistency. He's always good. He's got a big leg. He always hits on the extra points, and he just doesn't miss kicks that are supposed to be made. And that's big. Jake, having a bad kicker can really hurt a team in the worst possible scenarios. And the Eagles aren't going to have to worry about that with Jake Elliott. He's clutch. He's got a big leg. He's accurate. He's everything you want in a starting kicker. And then they extended Lane Johnson to a massive deal. And I like this because, or not Lane Johnson, Landon Dickerson. Landon Dickerson's young, and he's very talented. He got his big payday that he deserved, a multi-time pro bowler at this point, and now he's got a lawnmower, too. First big paycheck, he bought himself a lawnmower. I mean, Landon Dickerson's good, and you want to keep this offensive line together since you're already losing Jason Kelce. I'm still kind of wondering what they're going to do at that guard position, because I'm assuming they're moving Cam Jurgens to center. That's what I hope they do. But retaining Landon Dickerson is definitely big for them, and I'm glad that they were able to do it. And it was for a lot, but Landon Dickerson has really proved himself over the past couple of years to be one of the best guards in the NFL. So, overall, I will give the Eagles free agency a B+. They addressed some of their needs with the Devin White and the CJGJ signings. They signed Saquon Barkley, who's been one of my favorite players in the NFL ever since he arrived. This has definitely been a successful Howie Roseman-esque free agency, and the best is yet to come. It's Howie Roseman. We all know what he can do on draft night, and I think that the Eagles are going to do something big on draft night. What that is, I'm not sure, but Howie Roseman's always got a couple tricks up his sleeve, and I think he's got at least one more for the draft. So now, I want to talk a little bit about March Madness. So, I filled out a bracket for March Madness, as most people do, and in short, my bracket was horrible. I mean, absolutely terrible. My champion that I picked was Iowa State. I thought that after what they did to Houston in the Big 12 championship game, that they were really being slept on. I think that they should have gotten a number one seed, and they did not. I thought that Iowa State had a good chance to win it all. They ended up losing to Illinois by 3 in the Sweet 16, but my bracket was just bad. But I will tell you about the two upsets that I predicted. So, for a little context, when I do my bracket, I am very biased. Just for more context, last year, my champion that I picked was Penn State. They lost in the round of 32. But I pick off a lot of bias, which is why I picked Yale to beat Auburn in the round of 64. And I was following the game on my phone, and Pulakidas hits that 3, and I was like, my bracket is saved. People were saying Auburn was a really, really... People were saying Auburn was really, really good for a 4 seed. And then they got beaten by Yale, and basically a guy named John Pulakidas, who no one ever heard of, just went on fire and torched the Tigers and was able to lead Yale to a victory in the round of 64. Then I actually had Yale going to the Sweet 16 because, I'm very biased when I make my picks. And they ended up losing in the round of 32 in an ugly game against San Diego State where they just couldn't do anything. And the other major upset I predicted was James Madison over Wisconsin. Unlike a lot of fans of teams in the Big Ten, I actually dislike other teams in the Big Ten. I know most people, when they're rooting for a team like Penn State like I do, they like all the Big Ten teams except for like Ohio State and Michigan. I just dislike them all. And I thought just Wisconsin was not any good, because I saw Penn State beat them this year, along with a lot of other teams that Wisconsin lost to. They had a huge drop-off, going from ranked number 6 overall to just falling out of the rankings entirely, but they won the Big Ten tournament and got in as the 5 seed. I didn't think that was going to last, because I picked James Madison, a team that was ranked a lot of the year and only lost, I think, 3 games. I picked the Dukes to beat Wisconsin, and I was correct. But other than that, my bracket was not good. I did not predict the Oakland over Kentucky upset. I actually had Kentucky going to the Final Four, but that obviously did not age well. That guy on Oakland, he only attempted 8 two-pointers the entire season, which is just wild, and he averaged 12 points per game. I mean, obviously he caught fire against Kentucky and scored over 30, but I mean, only attempting 8 two-point shots the entire season is just wild. You can't help but wonder, he had to be the most inefficient player in all of college basketball, because that is just an insane stat. But he caught fire at the right time and led Oakland, which isn't even Oakland, California, it's Oakland, Michigan. He led them to a victory over the Wildcats, and almost led them to a victory in the second round, where they ended up losing in overtime. There's still one Cinderella story left as we look to the Final Four, however. The first matchup is pretty standard, a little bit surprising, but pretty standard. UConn versus Alabama. Alabama, it's their program's first ever Final Four appearance, which is pretty, which you would think is pretty surprising, but they're also a 4 seed, so they were projected to do good anyway. And then you got UConn, who's just been absolutely insane during this tournament. I mean, insane. Against Illinois in the Elite Eight, mind you, the Elite Eight, the game was tied, and UConn went on a 30-0 run. And I couldn't help but wonder, if I was an Illinois fan, how terrible must it have felt to watch that game live? Just UConn scoring and then getting a stop and then scoring again over and over again. That had to be painful to watch. So UConn bulldozes their region en route to a Final Four appearance. And then on the other side, you definitely have some surprising games. Final Four on the other side of the bracket is Purdue versus 11 seed NC State. So first I'll talk about Purdue for a brief second. And I am not a Zach Edey fan at all. I think that he's really not that good. I mean, obviously he's really good in college basketball. And he leads the country in scoring, unanimous All-American. And I won't deny how good he's been in college, but I don't think his game translates to the NBA, because when you look at him, like, he's 7'4", but he's just not, he doesn't really excel at anything. He doesn't shoot very well. All he does is just do simple hook shots. I think that he will be not as good in the NBA. I think that the physicality of the NBA will get to him. I'm not saying that he's bad by any means, but I just think that he's not ready for that level of competition. But Purdue, who has been dubbed as a perennial choker and lost to Fairleigh Dickinson in the first round last year, they've been very good this tournament. They had a really nice win over Tennessee where Edey scored 40 points. I mean, Purdue's a really good team this year, and I'm surprised that Wisconsin beat them in the Big Ten championship game, but Purdue is looking like the biggest threat to UConn winning the whole thing right now. But standing in Purdue's way to a championship game is North Carolina State, not Tar Heels, but the Wolfpack. And what's crazy is the NC State's record when the regular season ended was 17-14, which is a team that really might not even make the NIT under normal circumstances. But they caught fire and won the ACC tournament, which was just enough to get them in as an 11 seed. And then they've just been winning and winning against the best teams in the business. They just beat Duke in the Elite Eight. And I mean, it's insane. Because they haven't lost in like a month. It's like a joyride for NC State and its fans. I mean, it's pretty cool what's happened. I would not be surprised if they just win the whole thing because they just haven't lost in ages. It's just insane what they've been able to do. So, I'm going to give you my pick for who's going to be the champion. And I think it's going to be UConn. It might sound boring, but if you've watched UConn at all during this tournament, you know that they're going to be hard to stop. They have just been insane this entire tournament. They've been running through everybody, and I don't expect that to stop anytime soon. If I had to pick a team I wanted to win, I don't hate UConn, but seeing NC State win would be pretty cool. I believe they right now have 25 wins on the season, and if they're able to win, it means they will have won 10 straight games to end the season, all against really good teams, which is really, really impressive. I think that would be very cool to see. So my pick, though, is still UConn winning, and I think that in the other Final Four game, I do think Purdue probably wins this one. I mean, 40 points from Zach Edey is pretty crazy. I mean, DJ Burns is a good player, but Zach Edey's got a lot of height on him. I think it'll be a close game, but I think NC State's magic will run out against Purdue. So my championship game prediction is UConn versus Purdue, 2-1 seeds, and I think UConn ends up winning that. I think UConn is just way too good, and I think that they'll just run through whoever they end up facing in the final, whether that be NC State or Purdue. So that is my March Madness Final Four bracket. I mean, obviously, my bracket did not turn out so well, but I do think that most people's will, because a lot of people picked UConn to win this year, them being the number one overall seed, and obviously that's turning out very well for them. So March Madness is not disappointed this year, so I'm excited to see what happens the rest of the way. So now, we're going to get into the Phillies. They had their opening day on Friday because of a Thursday rain makeup after it was raining. Or actually, it didn't end up raining that much on Thursday, but it was bad weather on Thursday. They started on Friday, lost 9-3. Then they lost 11-4 on Saturday. And finally won their first game yesterday on Easter, 5-4. And tonight they play the Cincinnati Reds. Christopher Sanchez is starting for them. And I'm actually going to that game. My sister is singing there as part of Council Rock South's choir. But I'm excited for that. But I do have some concerns about this Phillies team. So first, I want to just talk about the closing role for the Phillies, which has been definitely a talking point this year when it comes to this team so far. And the consensus has been you either want Alvarado or you want someone else, whether that be Kerkering or I've heard a lot of Jeff Hoffman. I think Alvarado is probably going to end up being the guy, but what I think Rob Thompson should do in this situation is just give everybody that is a contributor in that bullpen a chance. I think you give Alvarado a chance. He's actually the one who closed out the game yesterday. You definitely want to give Hoffman a chance, who's just been amazing as of late, dating back all the way to last season, and he's pitched 2 scoreless innings this season. The only other relief pitcher who's done that is Junior Marte, who I am begging for them not to give him a chance to close. And I also think they should give Soto a chance to close, because he had 30 saves with the Tigers when they traded for him. I mean, he's basically the only guy on this Phillies roster who has extensive experience closing. I think Thompson would be foolish not to give him a chance, which is basically what he did last year. He just did not give Soto the opportunity to close because Soto started off the season rough. But I think you give him a chance to close. Maybe you give Kirk a ring if no one else is working out. But I do think a closer will emerge. If you ask me, I think the closer is going to end up being Alvarado in the end, because he's the most closer-esque pitcher. He's got really nasty stuff, good breaking ball. He's got everything that really a lot of prototypical closers have. But I think Hoffman's got a good chance too, because Hoffman is just really, really good. I think Hoffman is really good in whatever role Thompson decides to make him, whether that be closer or just a setup guy, which is kind of what he is now. But my main concern, other than like the bullpen in general, is Thompson's managing, more specifically the lineup and the bullpen choices. In the first game, Alvarado was not good. He put him in the eighth inning, and it was not pretty. So the way that game went, Zach Wheeler started out by pitching six scoreless, and I think you should have kept him in for another inning because he was under 90 pitches, but Thompson decides to pull him, which I don't have too much of a problem with, and he ends up putting Matt Strom, who gives up a bunch of runs so the Braves can take the lead, which I also don't hate. I think Matt Strom is good. I think he'll come back from that rough start. But Thompson ended up having to pull Strom and put Hoffman in to finish out the inning, which he did. And then in the next inning, he puts in Alvarado. And Alvarado does not do good. He gives up a bunch of runs. He's really, really bad in this inning. The control is off. But I don't hate the move of putting Alvarado in, because over the past season, he's been one of your most reliable relievers. What I do have a problem with is what they did when they had to pull Alvarado in the middle of the inning. And they put in Connor Brogdon. Connor Brogdon was in the minors for the entire, like, second two-thirds of the season last year. He was not in the majors from, like, June onwards. And you're putting him in a high-leverage situation with runners on base? He sends them all home, and then some. I mean, Connor Brogdon is a minor league level pitcher, and you're putting him in that situation, and the lead balloons from 6 or 7 to 3. The lead balloons, I believe it was 5 or 6 or 7 to 2, and it goes all the way up to 9 to 2, and the Phillies are able to get one more across in the ninth inning, but it's too little too late. What a dumb decision on Rob Thompson's part, to put it bluntly. Connor Brogdon's just not up to that task. But what I'm really, really annoyed with is the lineups. The opening day lineup, the infield was normal, and then the outfield was Castellanos, Rojas, and Marsh. I don't hate that lineup, but I think that there is a better lineup available, which I will get to in a sec. The second day, the infield was normal. The outfield was not normal. It was Castellanos, Rojas, and Merrifield. And then yesterday, the lineup was terrible. Harper was out. Thompson said he was going to get a rest day anyway, even though there's concerns about his finger after jumping over a fence during the game on Saturday. But I don't hate that move. You gotta give your guys rest sometime. He also takes Stott out for a rest day. So the infield has got Bohm at first, Merrifield at second, and Sosa at third. But what really bothers me is the outfield. It's Castellanos in right, normal. Rojas in center, which is also normal, unfortunately. And then Pache in left. I mean, Rob Thompson, what are you doing? Rojas is not good. He doesn't have a hit. He didn't have a single hit this series. He's terrible. Rojas is not providing you anything offensively. And I know it's only 3 games into the season, and Rojas still has an opportunity to turn things around. But, like, it's like the apparent refusal to experiment with a lineup that I think is objectively better is just ridiculous. I don't think Rojas is cut out for this. And if you're a win-now team like the Phillies are, your main concern should not be developing young players that might not be good this year. Your main concern should be winning. And to win, I think the lineup has to be, you leave the infield as normal, then the outfield, Castellanos in right, Marsh in center, Merrifield in left. I think that is the objectively correct lineup for the Phillies. And in another episode of mine, I voiced my displeasure with what it seems like is going to be a platoon in center field, which I already, in that episode, talked about how I don't like the concept of platooning in a win-now team. But if you want to check that out, go listen to that episode. It's very good. But they're not even platooning center. It seems like they're trying to leave Rojas as the everyday guy, and they're platooning in left field. How is Marsh not the everyday guy in the outfield? Marsh, in the outfield, I think whoever you put in there, Marsh is always the second best hitter in the outfield, behind Castellanos, obviously. Why on earth are you platooning with Marsh? I understand the concept. Maybe last year you want to give him, you don't want him in against like really tough lefties. How is Marsh going to get better if you don't put him in against these lefties? And I know you might think I'm hypocritical because I just said that your focus shouldn't be developing the young players. But the thing is, Marsh has already proven that he can consistently produce offensively. He had 60 RBIs last year. Like, that's not bad for a guy who would end up being like a 9-hole hitter when you put him in with my ideal lineup. Whether you want to put Merrifield or Marsh in ninth is to Thompson's discretion. That doesn't really matter to me, but getting that production out of a guy at the bottom of the lineup like that is good. And Rojas, obviously he played a lot less last year, but he had 23 RBIs. That's not even good for the amount of time he played. He started playing mid-July and basically just finished out the season. I just don't think he's good. I think Marsh and Merrifield are both better. They're both better hitters. They have much better power because Rojas has zero power. And Marsh and Merrifield don't even have that much power. Merrifield had 11 home runs last year. Marsh had 12. But Rojas had 2. He had 2 in his 3 to 4 months of play. I just don't get the point of platooning left field when Merrifield and Marsh are sitting on the bench when Pache is playing and Rojas is playing. I would rather have Pache play than Rojas, as I think Pache can actually contribute offensively while providing still a good glove in the field. I'm not going to deny Rojas' defensive prowess, because Rojas is an exceptional defender. He's better than Marsh in center field. He's better than Pache in center field, too. But the lack of offense is just insane from Rojas. And I just don't get the point of platooning left field and not even center field. If you want a platoon in center with, like, Pache, Rojas, and Marsh, I'd be opposed to it, but I wouldn't be this adamant about it. Like, leaving Rojas in as an everyday guy is just ridiculous to me. The lineup for today's game hasn't come out yet, but I would be very happy if my ideal lineup is the lineup that's happening, which would be the first time that Thompson rolls it out this year. But I just do not like Rojas at all as a player right now. I'm not saying I think he has no future in this league. I think if he does develop his offense that he can be a good player in this league. But not right now. The Phillies should be focused on winning the World Series. I mean, you're not going to have some of these guys like Schwarber and Castellanos forever. I mean, like, I don't know why they're so focused on developing Rojas when you've got these already proven guys sitting right there for you. I just don't understand it. I just think it's completely ridiculous. But the Phillies right now at 1-2, I think they'll have a good season, a good bounce back series against the Reds. I still think that they can win 95 games this year. I'm not too worried about the team in general. I'm just very upset about the lineup so far in the season. So before we end today's episode, I just want to talk about the Sixers for a little bit. Joel Embiid is coming back soon. The reports on his progress have been good, but man, do we need him back quick. Right now, the Sixers are 40-35. They're 8th in the East. They just had a nice win against the Raptors last night. The Raptors are not very good, but the Sixers also won without Tyrese Maxey, which is a good sign. But the sooner we can get Embiid back, the better. The schedule gets easier from now on. Actually, very easy from now on. We don't have that many tough games left. We're done the West Coast road trip. I know we still have a game against the Thunder, but the Sixers just, if you can get Embiid back with maybe 3 to 5 games left in the season, like, you can maybe even leapfrog the Pacers and the Heat and maybe sneak into that 6th spot in the East, which, one, would have you avoid the play-in, and two, would also mean you would get to play, likely, the Cavaliers, which I really like the Sixers in that series because the Sixers have been very good against the Cavs this season. They just recently had a very close game against the Cavs. They lost, but they were in it the whole time, and Maxey just didn't have a good game. And I think if Maxey was on his game that day, they'd win easily. But I like the Sixers in a series against the Cavs. If they can somehow leapfrog the Pacers and the Heat, that would be amazing. But even if they're in the play-in, like, getting up to that 7th seed would be pretty big. Because then you're at home, and you just need to win one game to get into the 7th seed in the playoffs, which would give you, most likely, the Milwaukee Bucks. Which, I also like the Sixers in that series. Not as much as in the Cavs series, because I still think the Bucks are a very good team. But you're going up against Doc Rivers in a playoff series, which is always better than almost any other coach. And you're going up against a team that's very poor defensively and very inconsistent in general, especially with Damian Lillard. Sometimes he's Dame time, sometimes he's not. I don't hate the Sixers in that series, but I think they've really need to just leapfrog somebody, even if it's just the Miami Heat, to get into that 7th seed. Because I don't want the Sixers to end up in the 8th seed and end up having to play the Boston Celtics in the first round, if they can even get out of the play-in. Because playing the Boston Celtics in the first round is a death sentence for that team. They're done. They're cooked. They're probably getting swept in that scenario. But we gotta get Embiid back, with hopefully 3 to 5 games left in the season, get him back into things. Because if you have Embiid at 75-80%, that's not bad. You take that any day of the week, and that gives you a good chance to beat some of these teams, like the Cavaliers and the Bucks, if you're able to get out of the play-in, or win in the play-in. I mean, getting Embiid back and adjusted to the NBA again is huge for the Sixers, and it's definitely a priority. The progress with Embiid, from what I've heard, what Nick Nurse and the Sixers have said, is good, which obviously is a very good sign that we're going to get him back sooner rather than later, but I just can't wait for Embiid to return, because then I'll have at least some confidence in this team, because for the past month, nobody has had any confidence in this Sixers team, but now, with Embiid coming back soon, people are starting to have their heads up a little bit more and actually have the impression that the Sixers actually have a chance, which I hope they do. I hope Embiid gets back soon, but it remains to be seen what the Sixers can do the rest of the season with not many games left at all. So, to end today's episode, we're just going to talk about the Flyers very briefly. So, last time I talked about the Flyers, they were 3rd in the Metropolitan and firmly in position to go to the playoffs. Now, they've lost 4 in a row, and they're barely clinging to the last wild card spot. They're seeded number 8 in the Eastern Conference, out of 8 playoff teams, and they've lost 4 in a row. They're only 2 points ahead of the Detroit Red Wings, who are in 9th, but the Red Wings have also lost 4 in a row. So that is at least something good for the Flyers to look at, but they have to start winning some games. They have 7 games left in the season, and they really, really have to start winning something, because right now they're just not winning any games. They actually have the same amount of points as the Washington Capitals, who are now 3rd in the Metropolitan. And the Capitals have lost 2 in a row, plus the Sixers have a game against the Capitals, which could end up being huge. It's the last game of the season. If the Flyers can just start winning again, if they can start getting more production out of Sam Ersson and their other goalies, then they've got a chance. But right now, the way they're playing, they might miss the playoffs. They're only 2 points ahead of the Detroit Red Wings, but then they're also tied points with the Washington Capitals. So these next 7 games, the last of the season for the Flyers, are going to be huge for them in their playoff push. I hope they're able to do it, because if they're not, the position that they were in, even just earlier in March, the season would be deemed a failure, even though nobody expected this team to even come close to scratching the playoffs this year. So I'm worried about the Flyers. I do think they'll get into the playoffs, though. I think they could leapfrog the Capitals, but even so, with the Red Wings having also lost 4 in a row, I think that the Flyers can still definitely get into the playoffs. Although it would be tough getting into the playoffs as an 8 seed, which is what they're in right now, because then you'd end up having to play the New York Rangers in the first round, which is not good, because the Rangers are 50-20 this year with 104 points, which is very, very good. So as the standings stand right now, the Flyers are in the playoffs, but they've been trailing as of late. They've really got to get their heads back into the game and start winning some games. But that's going to do it for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed. I know this one was a lot longer than they usually are, but I will do my best to upload more consistently, and we'll see you next time on the next episode of Philly Sports Deep Dive.